The talk I'm going to give is if you will, report from the front of dirty practice, of what it means to wrestle with the idea of trying to integrate sustainability into a big practice, into a real practice, into a commercial practice, and really some of the ideas that we've been wrestling with for a long time. And as such, it's really a journey, and this is sort of a travelogue, if you will. It's really to show a journey on the way of trying to come up with something better. And immediately, we don't know where the end of the journey is going to be, and we're sort of in the beginning of it, both ourselves as a practice, and I think in general, the practice of architecture in terms of really what is this very overused word of sustainability. We've sort of frame our thinking about sustainability. I really, about 10 years ago, picked up this book, and I highly recommend it, and it sort of served as our guidepost, if you will, as our tour guide for this journey. And it's Susanna Hagen. And this book is tremendously dense, and it took me about 3 reads to understand what she was trying to say. But it, in the distilled version, it basically, she sees sort of 3 maybe tiers, if you will, of sustainability, and or 3 aspects that are totally intertwined. One is, the first one is symbiosis, which really means performance. It's a way to say performance. It's how the building performs. The second is sort of differentiation, how the buildings really respond to what's around them, buildings and urban plans. And third is visibility. And that is really almost the representational function of architecture. So I liken that. I love this cartoon. You know, these are the 3 levels. You know, there's, let me get the pointer here. Yeah, so this is sort of performance, response, and this, of course, is my favorite one. I'm glad Modern Man has sarcasm, but it really, I'm relieved to know, actually. These are sort of relates to the Freudian, you know, id, ego, superego. It's really that sort of 3 levels of personality that are all intertwined, all interdependent, that really have to do with green buildings and sustainability. So we start our journey with symbiosis, and this is Susanna's definition. And I think importantly, it's not just about the performance of the building as a standalone object, but it's a performance of the building as it relates to the totality of performance and how it relates to the bigger things. I won't read it. And that really is the beginning of our journey here. About 15 years ago, 12 years ago, I was very involved with our really first quote-unquote green project, which was 4 Times Square, the Condé Nast building. It's really actually a very simple program, a speculative office building, very large, 1.5 million square feet in the middle of Manhattan. It's simple from a program point of view, and in every other respects, enormously complicated. And this was we sort of put our toe in the water of sustainability, and it was all about performance. And what we did was we brought under one roof a tremendous amount of strategies that had been tried, that had been done, including mechanical systems and air systems and energy systems and so forth, and including the one visible part of the building, which was these photovoltaic cells, which were integrated into the building. And here they are. And really, at the end of the day, why were they put on the building? They really contribute very, very little to the energy, like a minute amount. One was we got it put on the building, and all the difficulties and sort of plowing the way through for other people and getting the approvals. But also, and the developer really understood this, the client really understood this, we really understood it, was that it was the one visible piece of representation of what was happening behind it. And then, of course, we struggled a lot as architects to say, well, what's great? What's sustainable about the building? It doesn't look sustainable. It doesn't. What is it? What? And it really came down to this good systems, or sometimes people refer to it as good guts of the building. And I don't read all the details, but really, again, it's about the insides. And I liken this to the body with the insides. I mean, honestly, it's the same, similar idea of a diagram that you have. It's what's happening under the skin. It's what sort of enabling the rest of the work of the body to happen, including the performance level and the perhaps the ideal level. Of course, and then my favorite slide of the whole show, you could also have a diagram like this, which is the inside of a body. That just because you have good performing insides doesn't mean the outside is doing a good job or doing work, or in Susanna Hagen's construct is being a good neighbor, is being symbiotic. And so, and then contrast this with this Da Vinci sketch, or this is truly how one needs to think about these buildings as being, having a good system within, but being codependent with a larger whole. And we got very involved with the performance of buildings, and the whole office got very focused on it, and we made sure our consultants got focused on it, we got involved in LEED, and we really put our oar in the water in this regard and trying to make these buildings symbiotic and perform at a high level. And these are actual real numbers that have come in based on built, measured buildings, not projections, not what people want them to be, but actually from studies, you know, this is real data, so to speak. And obviously there's a lot of room for improvement, but still this is pretty impressive. So I don't want to sort of diss the performance aspect of sustainability, because actually that's really the foundation and really the basis. But, you know, after doing all this work, we were confronted with a big question mark and a real, you know, like, so what? You know, so, okay, is this really what architecture is all about? Is it about the guts? What about the other parts? What about, you know, representation? What about response? And again, the Hagen really served as a very strong touch point for me in terms of developing the ideas for the office, in that, you know, the first one was, well, how do you get from an architecture which is more sustainable to a capital A, you know, sustainable architecture? What does it really mean to do that? And Hagen, the first thing was differentiation. So unlike, say, 4 Times Square, where, you know, building could have been green, not green, it was all dependent on what was happening on the inside. Here, the next project I'm going to show you, 11 Times Square, which just finished, but it took about 10 years from design to realization. We really explored this idea of response in a high-rise building and said, you know, well, this is the south side, that's the north side. This is, again, very simple program. A million square foot, 40-story office building. But again, everything else was completely as complicated as you can get in the middle of Times Square with all sorts of construction and person issues and human issues and political issues. But at the end of the day, here it is. And we were able to say, well, the north is different from the south. It's extraordinarily fundamental, but it was a very important first step. And what was interesting to us is that also the, this is 42nd and 8th, it's a corner. The crafting of the solar response also dealt with the urban response, which had to do with relating to pieces around it. It's a very complex three-dimensional site. So, there's one aspect of the building which creates a gateway to 42nd, and another aspect that really is more of a backdrop for that gateway piece, and that responding to the urban condition of 41st Street, and then of course the scale of the theaters wrapping around. So it was all very carefully done, and then this crystalline north-facing piece was sculpted to allow for views to adjacent really historic buildings. This is the Candler Building, and the building slopes away, and the McGraw-Hill building the building slopes away, preserving those oblique views. And of course, the whole building rotates so that this corner view of the Times is also preserved. So there it is today. Again, really got excited about the fact that the orientation and the urban response all were working together. And you can see the north side, more of a sheer glass, more transparent, and the south side is the first time real sun breakers were or sunshades were installed on a high rise in Manhattan, and also the solar. We really made a differentiation of the glass, so we're trying to make evident this response. And of course, it has the prerequisite good guts of the building, the prerequisite performance aspect. This just got a LEED Gold rating. And we've gone on to do other buildings, and we're not the only ones, but obviously it's a fundamental thing. South, north, solar control, not keep preventing sun from coming in. Office buildings in general are cooling dominant. They need to be shaded from solar control. This is in Shanghai. This is right outside of Washington, D.C., south, north. And then this just got finished in outside of Philadelphia for SAP Corporation, south-facing, self-shading building, atrium, and then to the north. Actually, this has just got its LEED Platinum certification about a month ago. It's a great building. But again, not to downplay these buildings and the accomplishments, but it's sort of, well, that's just a part of the equation. It was sort of, all right, in a way, we're returning back to the fundamentals. Good guts, response, before, 50 years ago, the idea of solar response was, a prerequisite in most buildings. So it's sort of, what are we really doing? So get into the next level, to sort of go back to the cartoon, the charm, sarcasm, et cetera, the sort of modern man, the representational aspects, and how do buildings really communicate, the communicative function of green buildings. So, of course, the great hero, our great hero in one sense is Ken Yang, and I call these spinach buildings. They're just, green is coming out all over them. But clearly, this does it. It responds north south. Or this is the southern hemisphere, so this is south north. It's festooned with greenery. It demonstrates green building. It's sort of starting to get at this sort of puzzle of performance, of response, and of representation. So, the next project I want to show, we were really starting to sort of probe this a little bit, and we were invited to do a tower competition for Banco Santander outside of Monterrey, Mexico, and it's just as a crucial point from a regional point of view when you have this plain of the Gulf of Mexico. Houston's probably somewhere up in here, so it gives you an idea, and Mexico City's in here somewhere, but it's just right at the place where the plane goes into this Sierra Madres. And if you get a little closer, this is the city. There's a river that goes through it. And then there are these two, this is sort of a break in the mountain, and these two unbelievable hills. And that was the, that's one, that's La Mitras, which is the miter's hat, and the other one is La Silla, which means saddle in Spanish. And they're so dominant. And they really, even though the rest of the, the rest of the context, unlike, let's say, Times Square, which is totally active and there's a lot of architectural response to here, not much to write home about here, but in terms of the sort of landscape, it was, it was pretty inspiring. So we had a building site that the east and west facades, again, office building a little bit more complex than the others, in that it was corporate headquarters. There was some program involved. There is a pretty complicated building, but in general, it was a slender tower. And really, the orientation and the views force us into this east and west facing tower. And we thought, well, is there a way to make a dialogue in the tower between this sort of unbelievable landscape and the buildings and start to bridge this gap of representation by looking beyond the building and plants. So here's the building, and again, great long, tall proportions, some sort of with the east and west sunbreakers really trying to make a dialogue formally with the ridge lines across. Here's the opposite way. And that infusing the building from an experiential point of view, from the inside out, with an intertwining with the natural environment so that there's a dialogue inside, foreground of the building, greenery, long shot of the context, greenery. So this is the base on top of the podium for the corporate headquarters in terms of their cafeteria. And then again, inside, outside, and then long distance landscape view. In the tower, every floor of the tower had this same approach, inside, foreground, and long view. And in this case, we, by extending the slab out and the extent out, and then extending it with photovoltaics, we were able to sort of resolve the issues of shading and solar load on the east and west walls. So that's the view from the inside of like halfway up the tower. So inside, foreground, and then long view. So that you, again, there's sort of breaking the barrier between inside and outside and really creating a connection with the landscape. And then of course the top, instead of a real crown, it had this garden. And really used, the form was very much architectural, but the landscape development really became the facade development. And working with the landscape architect developed this whole notion of using the plant material as facade organizer. So if you could see sort of the edges of the photovoltaic green planted edges are low, and our sedums, and then as you get towards the middle, it gets more to builds up to this bougainvillea, and over the whole facade made a figure, a red figure of using the blossoming flower. And from a performance point of view, this actually really worked, because I sort of alluded to it in terms of resolving the difference of a sort of east and west wall. This is the baseline performance of the straw dog building, which is basically tied to an ASHRAE performance level, which has about 50% glazing. And if you want to have an all-glass building, which has a lot of benefits environmentally and from a perception and experiential point of view, without any shading, without anything, this is how much energy it would use. It jumps up about another 20-25%. So from the baseline, we go up and then back down even lower, 15% for the passive shading aspects. Then the interior, like the basically the good guts of the building, the better performing things, the higher efficiency chillers and so forth, you get another 10%. And then an additional 10% with the renewable energy sources. So it really starts to get at these issues. And then water there is a huge issue. And very similarly, the green roofs, all those green roofs retained water. We were able to use it. We were able to use it for irrigation and so forth. And you can just see just efficiencies inside using the gray water and then using black water. So that's a 50% reduction. So the performance was starting to be there as well. So we felt we're starting to like, all right, we're getting somewhere. Maybe this wasn't such a bad route to go. And we started doing some research in the office about how to make this idea of the green edge, the photovoltaic edge, more, the Santander project was a competition. We explored the ideas, but we couldn't really execute it. And we started getting like, well, what were the issues that were going to arrive? How can you make this into more of a buildable wall? How could you really construct it? So we started getting in the idea of, well, how do you make a unitized modular approach for this? And really started studying irrigation and so forth. And insulation, actually, I think Haley Cohn, one recent grad, or very recent grad, did these for us last summer in terms of doing energy studies and so forth of this type of self-shading wall and energy generating wall. And talked to curtain wall manufacturers. So we started getting familiar and comfortable that, you know, it's more than just an idea, it really could be executed. So this was a view of the prototype from the outside, and this was our fantasy from the inside overlooking Central Park. And, you know, again, this whole idea of breaking the barrier. So while we were doing this, we won a commission for a really wonderful project for what's called a palliative care center. And a palliative care center is, it's somewhere halfway between an assisted living facility and a hospice. It's for terminally ill, but people who will spend, you know, anywhere from a year to 2 years at the end of their life. It also has classrooms and facilities and medical offices. It's about a 250,000 square foot mixed use building. And the guy who it's a nonprofit started by a Jesuit father, and he was like, look, I have to have a waterfront site. And he found, this is Lower Manhattan, this is downtown Brooklyn. Ground Zero is here to orient you. The Brooklyn Navy Yards are here. And he found this amazing site, which is one of the few south-facing waterfront sites in Manhattan. And here it is a little closer, and he wanted this to be a demonstration level project. We're thrilled to get it. We're right in the middle of doing the working drawings for it or design development for it. And as we were designing it this past summer, we really tried to apply some of these ideas of our research. It's a tough context in one regard. These are big, difficult buildings. In other regard, there's some really great green resources. And then, of course, you have the elevated FDR Drive right next to it and the river. And then there's also this little thing that's been lurking in the back of our minds, which is this historic TB Gouverneur Hospital. It's a national landmark, actually. And so the idea was to take these living units in this sort of very curvilinear shape that gave everybody an unimpeded view of the river and put that in a sort of rooms building up and over this podium that got us over the FDR Drive. And in that, we put the medical offices and the parking structure and the sort of classroom building and so forth, so that it really, from the residents, you got great views. And as in the very beginning, we were again, responsiveness. So we're really looking at the solar angles and, of course, thinking about this precedent, the hemicycle house of Wright, where, you know, as the sun goes around this tower, or this, in this case, this building, it always would address the different rooms of the building. And really, as it developed, we came up with this sort of tripartite, you know, there's sort of the butterfly, which is that, and the base, and the spine here that responded. And the butterfly, which is curvilinear rooms slab, really responded in essence to the curve or to the flow of the river. The base really responded to the speed of the highway, and the spine really responded back towards this very tough masonry context. So really in the butterfly is where we are pushing this idea of this green edge and using it as a buffer and a barrier and a foreground. And sorry for the fuzziness, but again, thinking back three blocks away to this edge, very similar program 100 years ago about how to deal with that and creating a sort of light construction on the outside that would have photovoltaic panels, that would also shade, have greenery, which would also shade, have greenery, which would also create a microclimate in front of the glass, but allow tremendous amount of glazing from the inside, and really create this wonderful, comforting foreground from the inside out, as well as speak to the sort of regenerative nature from the outside in. And again, working directly with landscape architects, using the greenery as a facade material, in this case, trees, stepping up and sort of stepping down in scale as you go up, and then more and more greenery at the edge, climbing vines, sedums, and then again, seasonal things, that so you have a sort of coloration that changes over time. Really looking and carefully crafting this very much from the experiential way, from the inside out. Again, this would be the last room you would occupy in life, and we really wanted to make sure it was finely tuned. And there's a far view, close view, that again, the whole idea of inside, greenery, water, city, you know, again, this sort of layered panoramic. And then in the summer, the overhang was tuned so that, you know, you'd get dapple through the photovoltaic cells. In the winter, it would be lower, allowing warmer sun to come in. In this case, we wanted the solar energy in the winter as well as the summer because of the use. Power generation, because of the improved angles, so oftentimes with these photovoltaic integrated panels, having them on the vertical surface isn't great, especially on the south, because of the orientation. It's not as efficient. They're very expensive. They need to be efficient. So we wound up with this green edge. The base, in a way, responded more to the solar orientation and the sort of a buffer from the highway. More of a second layer intertwined with a large passageway from this sort of, this is Chinatown here and the subway stop, and a lot of people would take this. This is an emerging park edge that Shop is designing at Lower Manhattan and ends in this, which will become, this sanitation department is being changed to Basketball City. They're moving out, so it's really become very vital, very revitalized. And this is a key portion to that whole gateway to the river, bridging over it, the spine intertwining through. So we really conceptualize this as a series of flows, if you will, of the sort of city flowing back and the highway flowing back into the space. And again, the whole performance is critically important and part and parcel with the, and not divorceable from the architectural expression, the architectural strategies. With the numbers, I'll walk you through how we got to 50% of energy use, and I want to say, for those of you who are into this stuff, this is 50% of a very high standard. This is off of the current level of ASHRAE 2004. It's 90.1 2004. So this is already 15% lower than the New York State Building Code up here. So, you know, energy use, getting less energy is very difficult. It's like going on a diet. It's hard to lose those pounds. The first tranche was really the architecture. It was really the orientation, the south facing, the self-shading. The second is a whole host of the going back to the good guts. Now we're making some significant progress here in terms of reducing that. And this has to do, you can see some of the strategies, sensors and elevators and exterior shades, and you know, these are all things that are good practice, but you have to sort of add them up. And then finally, the renewables. And for a building of this size to have 4.5% of its energy use, it's a tremendously energy demanding building. It's, people are there, you know, 24 hours, 7 days a week. There's minor amounts of medical equipment. To have almost 5% of that come from these green edges, that's where was a major accomplishment, and part of that was because they were tuned to their orientation so that they're most efficient. We also had a big geothermal pump using what's the groundwater and the river water that's right there. So we're close, almost at half of a very high standard. So we're like feeling pretty self-satisfied, and you know, we were like, well, we're checking all the boxes, and someone in my office even put a little face here, but there still was a little bit of a nagging feeling in the gut. You know, it's sort of like, all right, you know, so we're, you know, we had these discussions like, great, you know, same strategy in Mexico as you are in the, you know, Lower East Side is, you know, how there's a missing piece here, you know, and this is what I say, whenever you see this, you know, I'm having a personal crisis, but, you know, and we went back to our great hero, Ken Yang, and had the same feeling again about his work, and I'm not taking anything away from him, but, you know, this was the image that initially set us on our inspired us to kick us in the tush and push us along, and then, and this is in, I believe, Indonesia or Malaysia, and then a few years later, this is in London. And I'm like, well, you know, okay, you know, how much, you know, so where's the resonance with place? And, you know, Monterey, Lower East Side, are we doing the same thing? And I like to show this montage of a fine architect. I know both the father and the son very well, but I definitely have a problem with, personally, with this, the same building. This is in New Jersey. This is in you know, sort of semi-temperate climate, sort of harsh in the winter, as you guys know, and sort of over hot in the summer. This is in Hong Kong, sort of humid, almost tropic, and this is in San Francisco, sort of mild, moderate time. Same building. Is there some of the same crime being perpetrated here, if you will? So my inner regionalist DNA started getting agitated. And so went back and did some reading, and we thought about it and try to find a sort of link between culture and climate and performance and culture and climate and also in the Hagen book, she talks about this to some degree. And Charles Correa, who's a great Indian architect, wrote this. And he basically says, look, his point is you go back to culture, and at the basis of culture is climate. And it's hard to express without a lot of words, so I did this montage. And I think this is what he's trying to say. It's like, look, it's the same DNA, it's the same gene pool, you know, but climate is such a strong differentiator of culture. They're both happy, you know, except for the kid, but that's a different story. You know, it's really a determinant of all the stuff that's led to a vastly different cultural expression. So with that, we had this another great opportunity, and we got sort of thrown into the cauldron of Istanbul, which from a cultural point of view is just, you can't ignore culture, you know, there. It has been such a strong center of culture, center of a melting pot for really two millennia. It was the seat of three empires. It's the East and West. It's actually the bridge between North and South. That you have to be a pretty unfeeling person to go there to design a building and not confront the sort of culture and it's already set up for a sort of East-West dialectic and an East-West dialogue. So this is the Top Kapi, the terrace of the Top Kapi Palace, and this our site is here. This is where that site was just right across. And This is the view from there, from that it's very prominent, probably the tallest structure for a while on the Asian side. This is from the Sea of Marmara. This is the Prince's Islands, where they used to take the princes and exile them. But they had a nice view at least. This is how big the building will be. And this is just a diagram, early diagram, just to give a sense of scale of the other buildings. And that's the context. It's sort of an anonymous, locally, here's the site. It's very prominent regionally, but locally it's quite it's sort of an edge city context. And there's sort of difficult architecture around it, interesting but difficult. But there's also another context that you cannot ignore, which is the cultural and building context. This is, I believe, the Blue Mosque. These people are in love with geometry. I think it comes from really a prohibition on representation in Islamic art, and you get these unbelievable patterns like this. Cappadocia, which is sort of somewhere between man-made and nature. And we took all these and sort of put them in. We said, look, we gotta take all the other things in our brain and in our gut and performance, orientation, and overlay this whole level on top. And these are sort of early study models, and the form is actually quite similar in the end. We had a pretty difficult zoning cone, a conical zoning envelope. So we took that and ran with it, used the obelisk sort of site that it wanted to be, and harked back to this other profile geometry and started really working the building from the outside in and the inside out, and creating this form. And as we were doing that, you know, it's not, as you guys know, it's not only taking, it's not only sculpting from the outside, it's really it's an inside out as well as outside in process in terms of how the building works inside, what the core is like, what the dimensions are like, and also how the energy and the orientation works. We had the ability to tune and twist the building and optimize it so that we really were able to create two sort of cool sides of the building and two or hotter sides of the building, so that we really were able to diffuse the sort of three, generally these buildings have three hot sides. And of course, there's a lot of work being done in this part of the world right now, and every architect is looking like a precedence like this in terms of shading that building. So our thought was like, how do we take the hot sides of the building and make them bluer, if you will? So the Musha Arabia, which is a traditional screen and veil. And we started thinking about screening and veiling and sort of being a little irreverent. We started looking at other precedents for veiling. This is in the Museum of Modern Art. This is Paco Rabanne. It's a great fashion designer in the 70s and late 60s. And really, that's what he was working with too, this sort of idea of taking the body and screening and sheltering. This was another one. Started getting a little gold in there, which, you know, started leading us to this, and actually looked at a bunch of different art painting precedents for this project, because we were still trying to sort out this east-west issue and Klimt, you know, Vienna is sort of the east of the west, and Istanbul sort of the west of the east. So it's sort of like said, well, maybe that's a stepping stone for us. Even and the sort of notion of gold kept coming up and coming up, and then we looked at a lot more, and obviously we looked at very direct precedents as well, a lot of them. And this is from the Blue Mosque, and again, this sort of notion of geometry, of pixelation, of gold flecks, of taking a geometry and sort of putting an overlay of another geometry on top of that. And so then we went back to our need to screen the building. This was sort of a segment of the tower, naked, if you will, without shading. This was an idea of taking this sort of sun screens in this pattern and putting them as an overlay. And then And then this is the result. So more red, the redder it is, the darker color is, the less amount of solar gain there is, and the less amount of energy you need. So we then started to think about how that could be translated, looked at metal screening, meshes, filigrees, perforations in this sort of looser pattern over the glass, again, wanting to bridge or resolve the issue of the all glass building versus solar gain. And then this is the some of the elevations. It says a little bit cut off on the left, but this is the south side where you have more of a density of these screens in this pattern. This is the east side where they start to drop off, the north side where it's really just the body exposed, and then the north, it's the building slightly twisted. So the west side, which generally has a lot of solar gain here, is the third most, and it's, you can see the angled surfaces have some of this clothing, and then it drops off as it gets more and more northwest. And from the inside, these screens would be be like a shading fabric as terms of impression, that you'd see through it, you'd know they were there, they had presence, but and that they would have some sort of architectural presence, but would not overly impede views and so forth, and in a way even enhance the views. And this is the rendering, and you can see this is the north and east sides, and it's is the unclothed aspect, and then this is the oblique view of some of those metal panels, the golden metal panels, and somehow creating this sort of symbol of a sort of modern Turkey, if you will, or new Istanbul in the context of the old. The green edges and the greenery and the sort of need to sort of create that direct link have been subsumed a little bit into these sky gardens, which are on all, I'll just go back real quick, they're on three sides, and they sort of step up the building, low on the west, medium on the east, and highest on the north, and they become place two-story high places, and we are looking to make them buffer zones. They're two-story high. They have glass jalousies that they would change depending on the season, so that you can go in a very high building, have protection from wind, have protection from the elements, but still be comfortable enough that you can go outside, which for a tall building is quite difficult. Performance, the good guts, the infrastructure of the building is very highly done. It's more difficult in a emerging market, if you will, like Istanbul, but they are committed to do at least a LEED gold building here, and we'll see how far we get. So we were like, again, once again, nirvana, everything was going great. We think we skinned the cat, although there's one little minor detail that's also been a little bit disappointing about this, and that is the building. Now I'm going full circle back to performance, and that is the building in its context. This may be great, but getting to and fro using tailpipes is not great. And while this may be the LEED, if we are so lucky to get LEED Platinum, use half the energy that it would normally use, it's still taking a huge amount of energy to get these people to and from. Although I would say that in places like Istanbul, in places like India, in places like the Middle East, there's a lot more of this happening, which are smaller buses, which are much more efficient than single family cars. But nonetheless, it's not super efficient. So that brings me to sort of the last chapter of the journey, if you will, which is the need and the interest to do this on a more urban scale, to try to take these three, good performance, response, and sort of representation on an urban level. So this was these are two real photographs, no Photoshop involved. Taken by a friend of mine who's an architect and a helicopter pilot and a photographer. This is Orange County. That's the line in Orange County. I especially like the little river that gets subsumed. And this, of course, is Central Park. And this is the carbon footprint of living per year per family. Getting to and from, et cetera. We didn't do these numbers. I forget who did, but these are sort of widely done numbers. And this is Manhattan. So, you know, 7 versus 22. So this is really where the real numbers are, is in transportation density and so forth. So we had the opportunity to say, all right, let's do good building blocks. Let's make an argument for densification and density in an urban plan. And again, sort of the last step in the travelogue is Copenhagen. And you can see, looking at this, why the Vikings love this area, because it's just like, you know, every harbor for every boat. You know, it's just wonderful. And here's Copenhagen. This is the tunnel that goes to Malmo. And you'll notice this is very important, this canal, the shortcut, if you will. This was the competition that Dagmar was referencing for Nordhavn. And this is the sort of center of Copenhagen, the historic center, the old walls, the 19th century city. And this was traditionally an area of industry and shipping. And over the years, this sort of continual landfill that will accelerate. This is sort of the current state, and will accelerate even greater, and was the impetus for the competition, that there was this massive tunnel that was being built for rail and freight. Then all the tailings would go into building this new land. And that's what served as the sort of impetus for the competition, and say, look, we can now find a place for Copenhagen to expand. The program was 40,000 residents, 40,000 jobs, and 40,000 bicycles. And as I like to joke all the time, it's like, you know, with the Danes, there was a lot of discussion about whether the bicycles should have gone before the residents, which before the jobs, but it was front and center in the brief, 40,000 bicycles. Here is the condition. So our first observation, our central observation to our plan was, it's disconnected in a way. It has this umbilical that happens at the edge. The real organic growth of the city is sort of coming off the center. So the first thing we did was say, look, we have to connect the urban infrastructure, the rail lines. This is the regional rail line. We did a tail off that, which really was one of the main spines of the development. This is that that tunnel, the freight and bypass tunnel, which all the tailings will cause the expansion of the island. The second was, there's a real tradition in Scandinavia and in Copenhagen about the finger plan, of fingers of urbanism coming into greenery, and we sought to extend that in our plan to weave the greenery in. And finally, and I think the biggest and strongest move we made, was to take the canal and drive it right through the center of this development so that it really connected from the water point of view. And then there's a composite here, and that's the plan. So the first thing you see, I think, is two things. One is the canal that goes through, and the second is this big regional park. And the difference between this scheme and the three or four winning schemes is that we actually compacted and only built on about 40% of the area and left the rest as green space. The other schemes really had much more of a mat type of development over the entire piece. So this regionally scaled park is like the size of Stanley Park in Vancouver. Enormous, a resource for the region. The next thing we did was create sort of neighborhood building blocks. Each one of those building blocks were centered around a green space, which became a water purification machine that bridged over the canal. That two of them would form around a more traditional lateral canal, a sort of macro neighborhood that would be centered around a stop on the rail, which, if you remember correctly, the second, you know, the light rail that connected all the way back. So there's a stop here, there's a stop here, there's a stop here, and a stop at the end. So these sort of fostered, they were in the center of each one of these nodes, and this was a cultural node, so that there's equal walking distance to the center. And then finally, in addition to the park, part of the program here was to relocate the ferry terminal, the cruise ship terminal from the center of Copenhagen out and create a much bigger area for these large pleasure cruises to stop, disembark. And so we created a very long, efficient tourist village, if you will, or docking station with a tourist village, and you'd get your boat and you'd take it down. So that's the aerial showing the full build out after 50 years. That's the canal. Those are the four neighborhoods, the green space, and then the intersection of the canal and the lateral was marked by a agricultural tower and a powerhouse tower that would create these sort of totems that went down the canal itself. And here you can see a typical neighborhood. This is just in plan. This is one of these sort of what I call laterals. There was row houses, mid-rise, and high-rise housing. And one of the things, sort of piece of research that we did on this competition, we're part of a consortium that is exploring a modular housing idea using low-impact construction. And based on the idea of the shipping container as a module, not reusing shipping containers, but using the intermodal shipping container idea, and all this entire plan, the low-rise, the mid-rise, and even the high-rise, everything, the office blocks, everything were based on this module except for the farm towers. And this is sort of but a sort of scratching of the surface of the system. You can see somewhere here, it's introductory patent. We actually, this and about 10 of them just have gotten patent approval from the patent office over the last 3 months. And there's an additional 17 that hopefully will fall through the process in the next 3 or 4 months. So it's sort of moving closer towards actual reality. But you can basically see it's based on the idea of using a shipping intermodal shipping container as a module of building blocks and really creating everything from the shower to the window to the building block to the mid-rise to the high-rise, the stairs, the elevators, everything in off. Built in a way off-site. And what we did, our idea for this project was that, like, look, if this has got to be sustainable, it's also got to be economically sustainable. It's going to take 50 years to build out the building, the city. So the area that was further north, that was fallow, if you will, would become a manufacturing site for these containers, so that it was we call it the city that built itself, that it would actually be a site both for creating jobs locally, but also for export. From a water point of view, we use these centerpieces as places where the rainwater is collected and water reuse was done and reduced. And you can see, working with a landscape architect, the public space is very much, there's recreational spaces which are really constructed and very artificial, but then there are places for purification and so forth which are much more natural, and those are intertwined. And then the farm towers, most interestingly, I think, the whole 40,000 people and 40,000 bicycles and 40,000 jobs is a net zero energy. Most of the energy comes from using the seawater as cooling, and then what wasn't used, and then very low impact, obviously very efficient housing and so forth. but also recapture from methane and so forth from waste, from black water treatment, and whatever wasn't needed or whatever we couldn't make based on those two things were wind generated both on these farm towers, but also in the sea around the building, around the city. And this was a vertically integrated water growing and then farmers market on the bridge. And here you see it, another view, the canal, the farm tower, the sort of public food market as the bridge. Here's a view of the bridge with the apples and so forth, and really using foil tech and ETFE cladding, allowing growing material to happen as opposed to glass, so that you really can have these as functioning vertical greenhouses, and then that would overlook the whole canal. And then this finally was the regional transportation stop and the canal and that hub, the center of the thing at night. So that was a whirlwind through a very large project, but really I think it reinforced to us these three, going back to these three constructs, the three signposts, the three principles that Susanna Hagen first set out in that book that sort of set us on our way, and I think we try to embody it most in this last project. But really, it's all of these that you must have great performance, because at the end, that's what it's all about. I don't need to reinforce to you all that, you know, this is not a Al Gore speech, but it, you know, we have to reduce carbon footprint, and you have to get that from good performance. But also, you know, the buildings and the plans have to be responsive, and then finally, you know, there is the communicative role and the iconography role of architecture, and they all interplay and intersupport each other. So with that, I thank you so much. It's a real joy for me to be here and to sort of, I feel like I'm on home turf, if you will. And I look forward to taking your questions. And thank you very much for your time.
And you have three projects where you're taking this detail in section of the photovoltaic.
Right.
And I'm wondering, the other part of the story, what is the access to those planters? How do you structure in services of that foreground?
The question of servicing is and maintenance is extraordinarily important, and usually that's the altar on which a lot of these things die in practice. And the issue is all high-rise buildings or all buildings need a maintenance plan, and usually window washing apparatus on a tall building is just an enormously complex and actually fairly technologically advanced type of construction with arms that come out and so forth. So the approach to these is that you use the planting edge as a walkway, and also sort of embed a grate on top of it so that you can walk on it, the plants grow up, but it's a way to window wash from the outside in a less expensive way than a window washing piece of equipment. We're doing an all-glass building right now in Manhattan, and it's not that big of a building, but it's very highly regulated and has to go through New York Department of State, Department of Labor, and the apparatus is costing $1 million for a retractable arm and so forth. So the idea is to take that $1 million and put it, invested in, help that cover some of this gratings in the project. So in this healthcare chaplaincy palliative care building, that's what we're wrestling with right now, and so far it seems like they're going to do it. We'll see. The other issue with maintenance is irrigation. So because these things will die, and that's the last thing you want, is to have your facade die. And basically, the idea is to use the roof as a cistern and rainwater collect at the top and just basically have the water come down and distribute so that it always looks green.
I'm interested in the conflicts that you mentioned between the office program, which predominantly needs to be cooled, and the glass building.
Yes.
It seems like once you make the fundamental decision to go glass, you have to do a lot of other things to kind of remedy that decision. So I'm wondering, is the stylistic, is that a case where the stylistic supersedes the sustainable? And is that true, do you think? And if so, do you think about that inevitability of the glass building in practice?
I think that's such a great question. I think that's really central to the issues. There's this raging debate right now of glass versus mass, as it's called, all right? Because, I mean, you could see from those diagrams, you start out with a straw man building, and then the first thing you do is make it glass, you're going against the grain. This is where I come down on it. I think that I'm especially for office buildings, I'm very much in the glass camp from a sustainability point of view. All aesthetic, marketing, other issues aside, just purely sustainability. And one reason is that, our experience, we were co-architects with the New York Times building. I spent like 8 years of my life working with Renzo on that project. And that's really an all-glass building. It has a screen on it, but from a solar load point of view, it's all glass. The amount of daylight harvesting that actually can get done is unbelievable with an intelligent interior shading system and dimming system. Right now, the New York Times is saving 70% of their electric bill of lighting because of how transparent the building is. But it has to be, and the initial investment has already paid itself back in terms of the dynamic shading and the dynamic dimming. I also think that the energy performance, like on SAP Corporation, the one I quickly showed with the in Pennsylvania, that is triple glazing. And that goes a long way to getting rid of the bugaboo of all glass building, which is the low insulative quality. And I think within 5 years, 8 years, triple glazing in this country will become standard like double glazing is, and Europe it already is. And then finally, I think the most intriguing sort of thing out there right now is that there's this growing body of evidence that says that office workers that have more connection to the outside are more forgiving in their ability to withstand wider swings of what we call criteria. So if we were in a room like this all day, no connection to the outside, I think we would become hypersensitive to too hot, too cold issues, and basically really requiring a very particular band for comfort. There's more and more evidence that people, if you're in a building like the New York Times or 11 Times Square, where you have you're sort of in connection with the sort of cycles of the day, with the daylighting, with the cycles of the year, then the fluctuations in lighting level and in heat and humidity and cool can fluctuate wider, and you still maintain comfort, and that's where the big numbers are. So I think it's sort of evolutionary. I think for sure, like the most energy efficient building in one way or another is sort of the bunker, if you will. But I think at the end, it's as technology gets better, as we get smarter in understanding human behavior and also in controls, the all-glass building or the very transparent building it's already a norm, but it will become much more responsible.
Dan, your gut reactions are obviously very good when you make good choices on what you do. What kind of tools would you rather have so you could make some of the decisions more accurately, particularly in the schematic stages?
We,
They're not as good as what you do.
No. And to get them to be good, we need collaborators. So we get over the hump of getting good data by basically having engineers, consulting engineers work with us. But that comes with a huge price. The first price is a dollar and cents price, because you have to convince the client that, you know, they have to spend more money to do modeling. Second is, the client normally doesn't as much as you'd want. So the amount of cycles of iterations that you get for energy modeling is, you know, you have to use it sparingly. And third is time. You have to, you know, pick up the phone. When are you free? Someone else got further front of the line. Your project wasn't as important. Yeah, all the human issues and business issues. So there's just a friction loss, you know, of being able to rapidly get information back. Ecotech is a start, and we are sort of tantalized by the possibilities. As you can see, we're using that now on every project habitually. Any project that has to do with creating a new envelope. But my gut and my head is telling me that it's sort of garbage in, garbage out, and we're not really modeling them very smart. And I'll give you coming back to this glass versus mass issue, the mechanical engineer invariably comes up and goes, oh, another glass building, how are you going to shade it? You know, on the System Bowl project, this is the glass performance I need. It's a 0.25 shading coefficient, or SHGC, which I won't get into what it is, but that basically means a very dark glass. And if you saw our renderings, we were talking about a very neutral, very transparent glass. And we say, well, hey, wait a minute, buddy. We're looking at something that's more like a 0.35, which is a much more transparent glass, but you got to take into account the real performance of these screens. And each screen, you know, by the way, they're perforated, there's rods. I mean, so to be able to really come back, and also they're not regular, right? It's like 1 meter, half a meter, and it's done in a very impressionistic way in terms of the pattern. So what is the aggregate over time as the sun moves around it with the different perforations? So what can we really go back to the engineer and say, you know, the glass is 0.35, but the impact of these screens at the end of the day is something like a 0.25, which is what you were looking for. So we know that the building's going to perform the way you want it to perform with the energy levels. So that type of more specific real property, real, you know, rapid response would be great. That, you know, a generalist architect could use. That's the other thing. You know, basically it's like, well, this issue of experts is tough because it creates friction loss. And, you know, I have to always re-educate myself. What's R, what's U, you know, every start of every job, and even though intuitively you understand what the principles are. So is that like 2 months away? 3 months away?
To be continued.
Great. Thank you very much.